Okay. Today is Monday, March 16th. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We're going to start with an informational hearing led by Senator Chip Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. I am also a foster parent, have been a foster parent. We don't have any children, foster kids in our house right now, but I'm also on the board of directors of the Oregon Foster Parent Association. And I just wanted to let you know some of the things that we're working on the Senate side that may come your way eventually, depending on how they proceed through the Senate and probably to Ways and Means and what paths they might take. But over the course of my time as a foster parent, as well as my wife, Shelda Holmes, I think what we've seen is that Oregon rightly has been on the track where we want to have a significant effort to keep kids from getting into foster care in the first place. And that's as it should be. But no matter how good of a job we do on that, on any given day, we're still going to have 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 kids in foster care. And I think we owe it to them to elevate the quality of fostering in this state, to try to make each Oregon foster home a true home of healing. And I think we've got a ways to go to make sure that that's happening in each foster home. And to that end, we introduced Senate Bill 632, which does a couple of things. It essentially what it will look to do is to provide better support and training for foster parents, to kind of upskill foster parents to bring down some of the more challenging behaviors of traumatized kids, and thereby cut the number of placements that a kid might go through in a year. All too often, every time a kid moves, it just makes the psychological trauma a little bit worse. And so the notion is to upskill foster parents to bring down some of the behaviors and thereby cut the number of placements and hopefully make each of those foster homes true homes of healing. Then start with a rural and an urban project, and then expand that over time. And Representative Stark has been very, very helpful in that regard as well, and I appreciate his support of that initiative. I also wanted to tell you that it looks like we're going to try to amend that bill and make it a little bit more precise about what kinds of services and outcomes we wanted to have on it. And that was based on Senator Winter's recommendation, and I think it's a good one. So we've kind of pushed two of the more respected foster care providers together who were both interested in this kind of legislation, the Oregon Social Learning Center and Catholic Community Services. So they're going to work on some language. The Catholic Community Services had their own bill, and so we just are going to try to mend some of those so that we can all get on the same page rather than, you know, fighting over which bill should be taken up. So that's one initiative. The other is that one of the challenges I see for foster parents is they don't really have a real strong voice down here in the Capitol. They don't have a real strong voice when it comes to fighting for better training and better support. So I wanted to let you know about another bill we had, a Senate Bill 331, and it's been around for quite a long time. And it essentially will allow foster parents to come together and organize. I think that that bill is not ready for prime time this session, but I wanted to use it to kind of foster, if you will, discussion about foster care workforce issues. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, putting a traumatized kid into your own house 24/7, that's a tremendous, tremendous undertaking. And we feel like that those people should be well trained. Didn't really know what they're doing to help those traumatized kids. So I think what our Senator Denbro would like to do is to turn it into a task force bill so that we can really have some discussions about how to kind of strengthen the organizing power of foster parents and also figure out a better ways to recruit, but more importantly, retain foster parents. I saw a statistic in the testimony by the Oregon Social Learning Center that 50% of all foster parents nationally leave fostering within a year. Mm. And if we could just bring back 25% of those who, you know, are very high qualified and upskill them and have them tell their friends, I think we could really start to get ahead of this problem and really turn all Oregon foster homes into true homes of healing. The Oregon Foster Parent Association, I think, is also getting its legs underneath them. And I think over the next couple of years, you'll see them come forward with an agenda. Now they're just supporting bills as they see come fit. But the Oregon Foster Parent Association, I think, really needs to be at the table to figure out how do we really improve fostering in the state and make each home a true home of healing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gallegos.
Senator, thank you for the presentation. You just made me think of, one, I mean, I like the idea or the notion of training for foster parents, and particularly around trauma-informed therapy and how they can really assist in, as you call it, sort of a healing experience for the young people. I'm curious, though, do you know any of the data with regard to foster parents of color? Do we have sufficient families of color? And I'm assuming, and that's my assumption, that we'd have a maybe disproportionate number of foster kids who are children of color. I mean, is there a decent match or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I am going to punt that one to Lois Day.
Okay, that's good.
And that'll give her a few minutes to try to compile that.
Great, thank you.
I'm about to close an informational meeting, open a public hearing, so you have an opportunity to comment on those two bills. I just want to say before doing that how incredibly important it is that we have people in the legislature that serve as foster parents, because there's no way that you can really understand that unless you've been in that place. And I know you have done that for a long time. Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward had a short period of it that intersected with the legislative session last time around. I'm not sure which other senators, but I know we lost a huge champion for that with Representative Tomei's retiring, but we've gained Representative Dwayne Stark, and there may be others as well that do. Are you a foster parent?
Not kind of.
Currently. Kind of. Okay.
That works.
Anyway, that is such invaluable experience, so I really want to thank you for your service in that regard and your insight that you can bring through this. And with that, I'm going to just close the informational meeting for now and open public hearings on House Bills 2890 and 2889.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. I just wanted to make some brief comments in support of House Bill 2889 and House Bill 2890. I was surprised that opening a savings account has what is such a challenge for foster kids, and it just certainly makes sense that they should be able to do so. And it seems like a lot of the credit unions and others are coming around the table to figure out a way to make all this work. So I just, it's a great idea, and I'm so glad that the Oregon Foster Youth Connect has brought that forward. And it's a great idea, and I just wanted to be on the record. Also, with House Bill 2890, I just remember the first long-term foster care placement we had, the fact that our foster daughter played soccer was just a tremendous therapeutic benefit to her, not just for, you know, the physical activity, but just for the connectedness of her teammates after school that she could hang out with. It provided some continuity. The coach was a very positive force in her life, and I just feel like the extracurricular activities are just a critical piece for normalizing the relationship, and I would support that bill very much as well.
Great. I wish you could be around to hear from the youth themselves, but you can catch it later.
Thanks. I'll watch audio. it on the tube.
I'm going to go back. Right. So I'm going to close the public hearings on 2889 and 2890 for now and reopen the informational meeting on child welfare and call up Lois Day, Director of Child Welfare for DHS.
Thank you. Members of the Chair Kindergarten and members of the committee, my name is Lois Day, and I am the Director for Child Welfare at the Department of Human Services. And I have a PowerPoint I'm going to run through quickly. Certainly, if you have questions during that, just stop me. Thank you. And I'm going to manage the technology on my own, so we'll see how that goes. So the charge of child welfare really is to improve family capacity and stability so that parents can safely care for their children at home and have environments that are permanent and lasting to support them as they move into adulthood. As Senator Shields said, we have long had, several years, had an initiative in child welfare to safely and equitably reduce the number of children who are in experience foster care. And to do that, we have a couple of points that we want to make sure we hit with families. One is that really it's best if children can stay safely at home while their parents address the issues that brought them into care. Going through that process of healing in a family gives children a sense of success and stability with their parents if they don't have to move while their parents are going through that. But there are families where children are not able to stay safely at home. And when they come into care, it's our job to ensure that they have settings that are stable, safe, and provide continuity to them, and begin, as Senator Shields says, the healing process while their parents are working on those issues that created the lack of safety in the home. There's even a smaller number of children where families are so challenged that the parents are unable to make the changes that are necessary for safety. And for those children, our responsibility is, as quickly as possible, find a safe and permanent living arrangement for them to grow up in. And finally, it's our responsibility to ensure our system matches the needs of all families, regardless of their structure or culture, taking those into account and increasing our staff's capacity in terms of their cultural understanding and coordinating and collaborating with partners in our community to ensure children's needs around their cultural identity is met while they're moving through our system. This slide represents really the impact of maltreatment throughout the life of an individual. I don't intend here to imply that everyone who suffered a traumatic experience as a child would then cause a traumatic experience to a child as an adult. But what we know is that the cumulative impact of traumatic experiences, unmitigated, causes increasingly poor outcomes and strategies that people use to get through life. And the earlier we can intervene in those things and help people to get those their trauma addressed, the better off we'll be, and the fewer high-end state services that will be used. I'm the director of the Child Welfare Program at the Department of Human Services, and that's a small program when you look at the larger child welfare system that exists in our community. This slide is intended to demonstrate the number of different public and private entities that we work with to provide safety for children in the community and when they come into our care. So we don't do this alone in any sense. We're an intervention program. We're somewhat at the end of the line of the child welfare system, but a critical component of that system. This shows you sort of this inverted funnel of contact we have with families as we move towards increasingly intrusive interventions and outcomes for children. We want people to call us. Because we are an intervention system and not a prevention system, we cannot act if we don't receive a call. And once we receive that call, you can see that on slightly more than one-third of them, we actually go to visit the family. So people call us for a wide variety of things because they believe someone needs to know. If they call us and we're unable to do something, we refer them to what community resources we know exists. But in order to be eligible for our services once they call us, there has to be an allegation of abuse or neglect, and that's a statutorily defined, abuse and neglect is statutorily defined, and that's what we look for. The data in this PowerPoint is from 2013 because the 2014 isn't quite ready yet. But in 2013, 3,730 children were removed into foster care. Of those, we had 1,117 that could be safely served at home. Excuse me, not of those, but with our assessments, that number is served at home. We had 817 finalized adoptions, which is up from 2011 when we last did a presentation.
May I ask a question? Is that blue line really like on the same level as the purple line? So out of the assessments, some are removed to foster care and some are given an in-home safety plan?
Chair Kinnegar, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes. 313 children exited to guardianship, and then we had 295 who moved from foster care into adulthood. Of these categories, we had fewer children enter care than we did in 2011, more children with finalized adoptions, more children moving into guardianship, and fewer children moving into adulthood from foster care. And those are the directions we want those numbers to move.
May I ask one more question? You may have this on a next slide somewhere else, but that's a point in time for 1 year. How many kids are in the foster care system at one time? Right now?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, I can look up the number. I have it.
Somewhere around 7,000 or 8,000?
Yeah, it's less than 8,000, but close to 8,000. And that's the average daily population. Mm-hmm. I believe I actually get that in a later slide. I'm sorry. So what's driving the caseloads that we have? It's abuse and neglect. It's neglect and threat of harm of neglect. I'm behind here. The most substantiated allegation of abuse is threat of harm and neglect. And within the threat of harm category is a category of threat of harm of neglect. And when you add those together, we have over 50% of our caseload has that founded allegation in it. And what we found was that children who experience neglect and threat of harm of neglect tend to come into care at a higher rate than children experiencing other forms of abuse, and they stay longer. So it's important that we get an intervention that's effective with those families. We have what are called family stressors for those children that do get founded allegations of abuse. And the largest single family stressor is drug and alcohol abuse. And the next most common stressor is domestic violence. And you can imagine the third most common family stressor then is parental involvement with law enforcement when you put those two together. So 45% of the founded allegations of abuse, those families have a family stressor of drug and alcohol issues, 32% domestic violence, and 26% involvement with law enforcement. There's a fourth family stressor called family financial distress. And in the fiscal year 2013, of the 3,370 children that entered care, of those, 43% received TANF prior to entry, which is up 17% from 2007. So what we know is that families in financial distress resort to coping strategies that are not functional for the safety of children, and that drives children into care. Well, now we've got mute. Oh, there we go. This shows you, as I said, there's categories of abuse and neglect. Neglect itself is almost 41%. Threat of harm is 44%. Physical abuse and sexual abuse, much smaller. Mental injury, very small. And where do children go when they leave foster care? Over half of our children go home to their families, and that is higher than the national standard. Then we go through the decreasing levels of permanency from most permanent other than return home, 21% to adoption, and then followed by guardianship, emancipation, other, and living with relative. A category in other would be a child who was chronically in runaway status, and then the court dismissed their petition.
Lewis?
Yeah, I have a question.
A question, please. I need a clear definition of guardianship.
Guardianship is a legal resolution where a guardian is established by the court and the department is dismissed.
So it doesn't have to be a blood relative?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Rep. Peluso, no.
Thank
it
you.
Does not. Living with relative is a little bit different federal category report, and what it really means is that we returned a child to the parent who did not have custody when we removed. So it's a small portion, but it's not returning to any relative. It's just living with the parent other than the one we removed from.
Thank you.
So in Oregon, we're experiencing a decrease in the rate of foster care per 1,000 children. Oregon has long relied on foster care as a safety strategy, and it's an important safety strategy, but we've over-relied on that in the past. which is part of why we are having this effort to reduce the number of children that experience care. It's an essential service. There's not one child welfare program in the country that isn't somehow associated with a foster care program. But it's intended to be temporary, short-term, and the longer it goes on, the longer the impact of a lack of permanence for children occurs, and that has its own outcomes that are not as positive. So the goal is to get a child to a permanent living situation that they can depend on and is stable as quickly as possible. The federal level of children in care per thousand is 5.4%. So we still have a ways to go in Oregon, but we are seeing positive progress towards that outcome. There are some metrics we look at across the system as a whole to assess how we're doing and to make sure we don't have unintended consequences in one end of the system from efforts on the other end. So in 2013, from 2017, we have had a reduction in the number of children who experience at least one day in care. And you can see that in 2013, 12,000 children experienced at least one day. The average number of children in foster care in 2013 was 8,447, and that's been further reduced in 2014, but I don't have that number today. And the number entering care has decreased as well. Those are all moving in the direction we want them to move. These are...
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. Maybe you're going to cover this later, but are you going to be talking at all about any of the statistics around abuse that occurs while in foster care?
You know, I'm not certain I have that here, but we can have that conversation. I do know the rate of abuse in care.
And that is?
That's it. No. And I know quite a few other things as well, but I
just... I'm sure, yes.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Taylor, we can address some of that
when we
get to that point.
Okay, thanks.
These are some of the metrics that we want to see go up. The number of foster children we're able to actually place with relatives, and we're up on that. The number of victims of abuse who were served at home, we're increasing in that. And the absence of repeat abuse, which means once we intervene on a family, is that child abused again within 6 months after placement back home or remaining in the home? And we have it's the absence of repeat abuse. It's at 95.4%, which means it's 4.6% are re-abused once we have our initial intervention. We want that number to be 100%. There we go. So we can talk about the foster care experience. It just happened to be the next slide.
Okay.
When children are committed to the department, we have an obligation and a commitment to ensure their well-being and their recovery. And paramount in that is their safety. And I know there's been some information out in the past couple of weeks about some instances where children were not safe in care. And as I said, we take that extremely seriously. Our absence of abuse in foster care rate is 99.1%, and one case is too many. So our goal is to have that statistic or that metric at 100% as well, that 100% of children who enter care do not experience an instance of abuse. These are several things that we pay attention to while children in care and that we feel are strategies that help them begin the process of recovering and keep them connected to their communities and their families. We have a preference for placing children with fit and capable relatives. Their educational success is important, and we have been working with the Department of Education around an effective transfer of information between their department and our system, as well as working to keep children in their home schools, and when they can't, that their records follow them quickly so that they don't have any lack of information in their next school. We have a program to support children who are in care to adulthood if they're unable to leave foster care. We have efforts to tend to their mental, emotional, and physical health. Every child that enters foster care gets what's called a CANS assessment, which is an assessment of their I'm sorry, I'm blanking on what CAN stands for. It's a specific assessment to determine their needs, mental health and health needs while they're in care, as well as a mental health assessment. And we have several things we do to hopefully ensure a safe and healing home. Some of the ways we look to prevent an incident of abuse in foster care is to have a large pool of foster parents who have skill sets that we can then match with the needs of children as they enter care. Face-to-face contact with children on a monthly basis, both in their home and outside of the home, an opportunity to speak with children in the absence of foster parents. Every child that comes into care has court oversight of that placement with a court-appointed attorney, and in many cases there are CASAs appointed, although there's not enough CASAs to go around for the number of cases. If there is an incident in foster care, we have what's called a sensitive issue report that we receive. We can call a critical incident review, which is a team that evaluates what's happened to look for systemic issues that we might use to improve our system. There's the Foster Care Ombudsman, which this legislature created last session, who is now on board and is an independent line for foster children to access, separate from their caseworker, separate from their foster parent, if they feel that need. And the better trained our foster parents are, the more access they have for training that then helps them match the skill sets that children's behaviors bring to them, keeps them safe. We have every district has a process for reviewing both allegations of abuse of foster care and concerns, which are calls we get that don't rise to the level of an allegation but create some concern around the care of that child.
Yes, Representative Taylor.
Thank you. Chair Kenny-Geyer, are you going to be covering what that distinction is?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Taylor, the distinction between concern and allegation?
Yeah.
The distinction has to do with the definition of abuse in the statute.
Okay.
So if there's an allegation that a child's is in foster care and isn't getting their, say, clothing needs met, their coming to school, allegedly unclean or too tired to study to participate mm-hmm. in the school, that in and of itself wouldn't rise to the level of an allegation of abuse, but it would be a concern because it would indicate that the foster parents were not potentially not caring for the child at the level that is expected by our rules. So that could get a visit. It might not get a visit to determine if abuse is occurring. It would get the caseworker out to visit the child versus a CPS worker. If the allegation is bruising, that because of something the foster parent did, or even unexplained bruising that the child can't explain, that could rise to the level of abuse, and so that would get assigned to a child protective service worker, which is an intake worker, to go visit the child.
Committee, we have a lot of people who are on the agenda here, and we know that we're going to have Lois Day back, and you're halfway through your slides right now. So I'm thinking if you can speed it up and write your questions down, and we'll see if we have time. I'm sure you're going to be staying till the end, but I know that we have some foster youth here themselves, number of people, panelists. So we'll try to get through this quickly and then save some questions for the very end.
Thank you, Chair Geyer. This just shows you the effort we're making to reduce the number of children of color who are in our system. We have an inequitable distribution of those, and I know the question earlier was, do we have enough foster homes of color for these children? And the answer is sort of. As an example, we have sufficient African-American foster homes for the number of African-American children in care. However, there's sort of a challenge of geography. The children who come into care may not match where the foster home resides, and there's a challenge of whether or not the homes are open, because we may have a Caucasian child placed in a home of color, and that slot would be full and unavailable then for a child of color who came into care. So that's a constant challenge for us, to have sufficient culturally matched homes for the children that come into care. Last session, we were given both staff and direction to sort of transform our system into one that is has more than one approach available for us when we go out to meet a family. That's called differential response, differentiating the front door of child welfare so that when an investigatory response is necessary, we can do that. But when the family is not in a place where a founded allegation will be helpful to them or protective of the community, we have another way to approach them. So a family that's experiencing neglect, which is generally not an incident, but an accumulation of minor incidences or failures to act and omissions that create an unsafe environment. In those counties where we've implemented differential response, we are able to go out and engage those families in a way that doesn't make a finding of whether or not abuse occurred, but it makes a finding of whether or not the family needs help. The outcome of this is that no one has to be listed in the perpetrator database, which impacts employment and other things, even once the family leaves us. I talk a little bit about differential response in here, but we probably would want to address that at a deeper level if people want it at a later time. We strengthened our Oregon safety model and retrained our staff in the application of that model. A strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families programs, which is our service array, was established in 2011, and in 2013, we were directed to go implement that statewide. And finally, the legislature gave us a allocation of staff that allowed us to take our workload from being able to do 67% of what was before us to today, where we have 85% of the staffing needed to address the workload. And we have strategies for achieving that change. One is the increased staffing, the expanded service array, permanency roundtables, which are specific staffings to assist workers in finding ways to help children who've been in care for 2 years or longer exit the system, and our Title IV-E waiver, which is a waiver of the requirements of Title IV-E, which is a federal funding source for foster care, so that as we reduce foster care, we're allowed to use those dollars differently in prevention activities or foster care activities. In differential response, we implemented in the first counties in May of 2014, and our next group of counties will implement next month. And by 2017, we will have implemented in the entire state. But it will take until 2017 to get there. It's a technical and an adaptive change for our workers. The technical change is the easy part, but helping workers really understand this different approach for families is the adaptive change, and we're committed to staying with each county until they have cemented that adaptive change before we move to the next counties. Strengthening, preserving, unifying families programs are statutory, and they require us to enter into a collaboration in counties to identify gaps in the service array. We found some themes which I think help inform us around the challenges families have. These are the most frequently requested contracts from counties: navigators and parent mentors to help them navigate all the social service agencies that are involved with families, specific parent mentors, which are parents who've been through our system and come out on the other side, helping parents who are currently in the system move through it. Relief nurseries are very popular and have a wide array of services under that umbrella for families. Alcohol and drug treatment that also has other services available when parents are ready for it, such as parenting, domestic violence services, relief nursery services, all under one umbrella. Short-term and emergency housing services, supported housing for families. A lot of our families are homeless or in unstable housing, and it's very difficult to address the issues they're working with if they don't know where they're going to be staying, and very difficult to return children when parents do not have a home. And front-end interventions. We're able to take with us, when we go out to encounter families, specialists who can help the family focus on the issue that's driving them: domestic violence, mental health, drug and alcohol abuse, and generalists can go out with us when we do the first knock on the door. And finally, trauma and therapeutic services to help families deal with not just the trauma of our system being involved with them, but the accumulated trauma they carry that's causing them to function where they are. Additional direction last year was to increase services and supports for homeless and runaway youth and implement the Foster Child Bill of Rights and establish the Foster Youth Ombudsman. I'm going to skip that slide. That shows you how we're being collaborative with other programs. In the next, our ask was in the next biennium to let us finish what we started, get our 4A waiver in place, mature the Strengthening and Preserving and Unifying Families programs through outcome-based contracting, to put them on track for performance-based contracting, and continue our differential response. There's also an effort called Pay for Prevention, which is an effort which is looking to pull private dollars into the provision of state services and intervene with families much earlier in the process to prevent foster care down the road. We hope to move work with our partners in moving that forward this next session. And this just describes the different asks we made when we went into Ways and Means. I'm going to skip right over them for sake of time, but they're in there, and we can have conversation if people want to have conversation about it. The final is that there's some additional issues and system challenges that we'll be addressing during the next biennium. There's federal legislation, H.R. 4980. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's the federal legislation around commercially trafficked youth and strengthening permanency for youth. The federal government also reviews all child welfare programs, and we're set to be reviewed in 2016. There's some challenges with our waiver savings, with the federal savings, ensuring we have enough general fund to do the match when we actually accumulate the savings. And I am happy to say when we implement our waiver in June, we'll already have savings accumulated. So we just want to make sure we're able to spend all those. And then the last is the dependency representation. Our workers go into court without legal counsel pretty often, and we have a bill that's moving through on the Senate side to provide representation for child welfare workers in the court system. And the last slide, really what I'd bring to your attention here is the last two pieces, the child welfare data book, which we put out on an annual basis that sort of tells you how we're doing in all areas. And finally, the child welfare data set. All of our data is now available for public viewing and can be manipulated to create reports or compare counties, compare districts by anyone. And that website, if you have any interest in going there and seeing it, that's available now. And that's what I have.
Any burning questions, Representative Buehler?
Yeah, I'm just curious how one becomes a certified foster parent. What's that process?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Buehler. To become a certified foster parent, you come to the department and say, I'd like to be a foster parent. We start a series of conversations with you to find out why and what's driving you. Are you looking for a certain child? Are you wanting to be a general foster parent? And then we have what's called a Safe Home Study, and SAFE is an acronym for a structured approach to interviewing them and assessing their abilities and their desires. And we get references and a criminal record check. And then if they pass through all that, they can be certified.
Just follow up.
Yep.
There's been a couple high-profile cases recently and decisions against DHS. Where does this process break down?
Can I interrupt here for 1 second?
Mm-hmm.
You acknowledge some of those issues up front. I know I can tell from some of the questions here you have many of the same questions I have. With regard to the high-profile cases just last week, as well as in December, the court case that brought $4 million settlement, or not a settlement, a court case against DHS, there have certainly been breakdowns, and we do want to look into those. We will get really sidetracked if we get into that today, so we will have Lois come back to this.
Thank you.
And I want to make sure that today you have a sense of where the department, you know, what the programs are, where we aim to be, where we've made some progress, and really have a chance also to hear the foster youth and just at least a quick presentation of the bills. I promise you that we will get back to this because it's a burning issue. And did you have a quick comment, Representative?
Quick comment, question. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I understand the process, or at least I'm aware of the process. I don't understand it to become a certified foster parent, but and you mentioned that you have a pool of people that you can go to, but you also have guardians. Is there a pool of people that sign up to be guardians, which wouldn't necessarily be a relationship of a payment received for that foster child, but just somebody that would be willing to take care of a otherwise foster child?
Chair Kinnegar, Representative Hayden, we actually don't have a pool of guardians. Guardianship is a permanency outcome that we have access to if we're unable to return a child or achieve adoption. And so family members and or foster parents can become guardians of those children after we've gone through the process of attempting to return and ruled out the higher level of permanency of adoption. But we don't have a pool of guardians who step forward and then take responsibility for children who come into our system without going through that process.
Our next speaker may be able to address some of these things as well. So I want to thank you for coming.
I don't have to gavel.
Okay.
I
would like to thank you, Ms. Day, and would love to call up the Honorable Judge Nan Waller. Are you coming up?
I was going to suggest, because I can make mine shorter, and
yeah.
So we want to make sure that you have the opportunity to hear from the foster children. I would refer to them.
You're going to do that.
No, they have a plan.
They have a plan? I'm being told by my administrator that they were part of the plan at going last so that they could comment on the bills, but this is very typical of you to put their needs first. So we'd love to have you up. So I'm calling Judge Nan Waller and Joanne Southey, the Deputy Chief Counsel, Oregon Department of Justice. I've noticed that you have a 38-page PowerPoint, so I know you're going to try to zip through these, but just so people know that you can always go back, and you have a lot in OLIS to go back to.
Wow.
It's upside down.
It is upside down. I'll put it right side up for you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. I thought I would bring to you some demonstrative evidence since we're talking about the court system. This is the first juvenile court journal in Oregon. The first juvenile court started in Multnomah County in 1905.
Did you introduce yourself? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm Nan Waller, presiding judge in Multnomah County.
Thank you.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Joanne Southey from the Department of Justice, Deputy Chief Counsel, the Civil Enforcement Division, and the attorney in charge of the Child Advocacy Section.
And I brought this today because I think that the story of Oliver, who was the very first juvenile brought before the court in Oregon to a juvenile court, he was a bad boy and a truant. And juvenile court started in Oregon in 1905 following the establishment of juvenile court in Chicago. The reason that that's important is because the recognition in 1905 and previously in Chicago at the turn of the century was that children are different and that we should have a different court that addresses the needs of children, that they are not simply small adults, that they have different needs, that they have different developmental needs. And the other piece of this that is, I think, very important to today's discussion is that juvenile court at the time came out of the work of many good people in the community, Boys and Girls Aid Society, other charitable organizations who recognized that systems and the court should not do the work alone, that it requires the community really stepping up to the plate when we're talking about caring for our children. And that's the model that over the past 110 years we have continued. A lot has changed in the 110 years since then, but the basic tenets of juvenile court, that the needs of children are so important that we have specialized courts that will recognize and have people who are trained in dealing with the needs of children, has held true. And that we need the community involved in caring for our children. So we're going to go over We didn't actually talk about how we were going to divide this
we'll
start, and you chime in whenever you want. I'm not going to go through this entire PowerPoint for you, because a lot of it you can do, and I know that we have young people who are here who really you do need to hear from in terms of what the experience is like. But the top 10 reasons, things that you need to know about juvenile court, are that juvenile court cases are different because we're dealing with children. They are complex. Juvenile law is complex. There are multiple different federal acts and state statutes, and the laws are complex for juvenile court. The juvenile court jurisdiction is defined by statute and then by case law as to refining exactly what those statutes mean. And juvenile court has jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction, for anyone under the age of 18, where there's a basis in juvenile court jurisdiction. You heard Lois Day talk about that for the majority of kids who come before the juvenile court, the dependency side of the court, that the issue is, have they been abused or neglected, parents who have substance abuse issues, domestic violence issues. That's the majority of the work that we see. We used to see a lot more dirty house cases, but that doesn't seem to be as prevalent right now. We have different hearings, and we have a fair number of hearings that are required. So unlike a criminal case, where a case comes before the court, a judge hears the plea or hears the trial and sentences the individual, juvenile court cases have a long life. You have responsibility as a juvenile judge from the moment the child comes before the court until there's a termination of wardship. What we never want to do is have that period of time last for 18, 21 years. We want it to be short and to the point, making sure that the needs of the children are met. So we have the dependency side of the court that sometimes results in, when there has not been the effort made by the parents and the issues have not been addressed, we move to the termination side of the court, which is done fairly infrequently, the termination of parental rights and then seeking adoptive placement. Juvenile records, and you've had some bills before both this session and previously on juvenile records. There's a reason why they are out of the normal realm of court records and why they are kept confidential, because we are dealing with children who oftentimes are victims. They've been abused or neglected, and there's very confidential and private information about them, and quite frankly, in this day and age of electronic access to court records, the idea that the records would be out there forever and a day talking about the sexual abuse of a child by a parent is not something that we would want to have. I think we could all agree that would not be a good plan. I've talked a little bit about citizen involvement, that it's important to have citizens involved, the kind of common sense of the community. So we have Citizen Review Board, we have CASAs, who are court-appointed special advocates appointed to represent the best interests of children. And then we have the community at large, and Lois talked a little bit about that, the faith community, the business community, people stepping up, school teachers sometimes who see that a child is in need and will take on the responsibility of fostering if there is that need to remove. We have model courts in every jurisdiction. The aim of the model court system is to try out best practices, to really look at and challenge ourselves as courts with all of the other stakeholders to the juvenile court community at the table to how can we do this work better. I think there is a great deal, if you ask any juvenile court practitioner, whether they're prosecuting cases or whether they're representing children or parents, or any juvenile court judge, you will find that there's a great deal of passion about the work because people understand what the impact is on children when we don't get things right. We are involved with our community partners, with the Department of Human Services and others, with a number of initiatives to really move us forward in making sure that we have the best results. And Lois talked a little bit about that. And then there's some bills this session that are of interest to all of you. I think this is one of the more important slides, so I'll stick with it for a moment. Juvenile cases are different than other kinds of cases because we're dealing with really sometimes life and death decisions about the welfare of a child. If I remove this child, will they be safe? what's the impact of foster care? If I leave the child at home, will it work out for them, or is there going to be another instance of abuse? Juvenile court is wonderful because you have really the opportunity to look forward. If we get it right, we know that this child will have a future, and we as a community will all benefit from that future of a child who's educated, who has the ability to form stable relationships, who stays out of our justice system, who looks forward and plans to be a productive member of the community. We know when we get it wrong, and that's one of the benefits of the 110 years of juvenile court being in action, is that we can see, we have the research that shows what some of the results are, which again motivates us all to get it right in the first instance. The juvenile court judge, sometimes judges sit on the bench and they call the balls and strikes on certain kinds of cases. You have a civil case, your job is to manage the jury, decide the case, decide the issues, same with criminal. In juvenile court, this both the statute and the practice is that the judge has to be an inquiring magistrate. It's the job of the judge, and we have very specific statutory obligations throughout the life of a juvenile court case to inquire of the agency, are they making reasonable efforts? In the first instance, reasonable efforts to prevent removal of the child, and then all the way along, up until the point where we change the permanent plan, and in almost all instances, the initial permanent plan is to return the children to the care of a parent. In the first instance, do we need to remove the child at all? And if so, what's the shortest period of time? What do we need to be putting in place in order to prevent that removal from a child from languishing in foster care? We're also constantly looking at the parent. Are you doing what you need to do? Are you in drug and alcohol? What's the progress that you're making? What else do you need in order to be the kind of parent that your children deserve? Are you providing the information back to the agency? So it's a constant inquiry of everyone at the table. And from the children who appear in court, and we always want children to appear in court, finding out what it is that they need. You heard Senator Shields say that his foster child played soccer. An inquiring magistrate wants to make sure that not only is this child not being abused, but are they being given the opportunity to thrive? What's happening in terms of their well-being? Do they have what they need to succeed in school? Do they feel like they are just a foster kid, or do they feel like they are a child in a family, whether foster, relative, or bio, that is doing all the things that kids should do? I had, as an aside, all three of my children grew up during the period of time that I was a juvenile court judge. So it was very hard for me not to stop on every case and say, would that be all right for my child? What would my child need in these circumstances? Which was a good accountability to me as a judge to make sure and acknowledge that foster children are like any other child and deserve just as much as each of our own children do. So constantly looking at, is the plan adequate to get back to get to reunification? Is there a concurrent plan in place? We're constantly planning, doing dual planning. From the moment a child comes into care, we should be looking at the primary plan, reunification, what's the backup plan, and are we making strides to be able to implement that backup plan in the event that we need it? We may never need it, but it's better to plan concurrently than plan sequentially. That takes too long for children. We are required by statute to make a significant number of findings, which also requires then DHS to present us a lot of information. The reason that that's important is that we know that those things that you have to count, people pay attention to. So if we're having to ask at every hearing, how many foster placements has this child been in? Mm-hmm. How many visits have they had with their parents? How many schools they have? That will have an impact not only on hopefully better results for the child, but what the agency does in terms of paying attention to the planning. And then finally, we act as a convener. Juvenile judges don't just sit on the bench and call the balls and strikes. We are often out in the community working at pulling people together, pulling DHS, CASAs, lawyers, community providers all together to see if there are things that we can do to improve the system. Okay. There. I'm not going to go through everything, but the ACES study, you probably are all familiar with the ACES study. It was done a number of years ago. There's also the Remove short film, and you all have this PowerPoint. It's a very powerful short video on foster care. You know, there's sometimes the myth that children are better off in foster care. I absolutely believe that we need great foster care homes, and you know, we'll work with both the agency and the foster care community to make sure that we have that. But it is a tool that we need to use very carefully because there are impacts of removal. If you just for a moment think about your own children or nieces or nephews or grandchildren and what it would mean to them to be suddenly taken out of the care of a parent, placed in stranger foster care, and expected then to function well, it has an impact on it. And I think that that's one of the big kind of mythbusters that there's been over the past 10 years as research has really come to the front in terms of what the impact is of foster care. So I would urge you to look at that little video. We won't go through it now.
So, Your Honor, maybe you a couple more minutes and then
okay.
See if
I'll just... Lois, I'm stuck with technology, but we will... There we go. I'm not going to go through everything, but I think that the agency would agree, the community would agree that judicial oversight of these cases is imperative in order to keep everyone on the same page and moving forward. That takes time, but it is time well worth. I think for the families and children who come before the court, it is important that everyone in the courtroom is represented, including children, and that the representation is qualified, competent, and able to understand what the developmental needs of children are. We love having CASAs. We don't have enough CASAs, and I would urge anyone who's interested in the juvenile system to consider being a volunteer, either through the CRB or a CASA. This is just a slide to show how complex our system is. You can look at all of this on your own. These are links for you in terms of more information, more in-depth information for you. Again, juvenile court jurisdiction, there has to be a reason why the child, and it has to be a statutory reason why the child is taken into care. I'm going to let you go through all of this on your own. This shows kind of the life of a juvenile court case. Our goal is always to try to come up to get a child to permanency, whether that's returning home or into an adoptive place in guardianship or placement with relatives sooner rather than later. Balanced against that is providing a fair opportunity for parents to improve the situation that led to removal. You will have in your handouts, you have a couple of slides that show all of the different hearings along the way and the findings that the court needs to make. We would like children to be in court, and there is the Foster Children's Bill of Rights. We try to set hearings so that children can participate and feel that they are welcome in court. This goes through the greater community. We need everyone in the community to understand that all of our children are the responsibility of the entire community. Most importantly, that foster children are because we have removed them from their home and they are then under the watch of the court and DHS. I won't go through what Lois already went through in terms of the initiatives that are currently, and then this just lists the bills that are currently.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Joanne Southey from the Oregon Department of Justice. Again, I am the attorney in charge of the Child Advocacy Section, and that section at DOJ is in charge of providing legal advice and representation to the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. The Attorney General is dedicated to providing ethical, independent, and quality legal services to state government, and also to pursuing justice and upholding the rule of law statewide. So within that realm, we help protect abused, neglected, and abandoned children throughout Oregon by providing vigorous court representation and comprehensive legal advice to that child welfare program. We have about 48 attorneys statewide that do this work, and we are situated in offices in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, and Pendleton. When I did this work, when I started at DOJ about 14 years ago, I started in Central Oregon. So I've had the fortunate background to appear in about 18 or 19 counties doing this work. So it is really enlightening to see how this work has changed in complexity over the years, and also how it's handled slightly differently depending on what jurisdiction you're in. As Judge Waller alluded to, there are statutory obligations with strict federal and state timelines around the placement of children in care. The Adoption and Safe Families Act from 1997 put forth the a few of those slides that were included in Judge Waller's PowerPoint, which you'll be able to go back and review. But it does list out what is required at each stage of these proceedings, which is quite complex. And the case law over the years has also put this intense scrutiny on those findings and made some of the forms that these judges have to fill out on the bench to be incredibly complex, like 9 or 10 page forms from a half an hour hearing. So it is essential that we do have quality legal representation to help frame the issues for the judges to be able to spotlight and see exactly what they're required to find. The section attorneys in my section, the child advocacy section, we provide a wide range of legal advice and counsel, and that ranges from an independent review of the DHS case file in child welfare offices statewide at two critical points in the case, at about the 5-month case and about 5 months into the case, and if the child remains in care, then about at the 11-month period of time. We have other pilots kind of out there increasing our role in court to see if that has a better impact on the ability to assist DHS than being sitting with them in their offices doing a file review. The contested litigation issues really run the gamut. I'm always amazed that there's always something new. Like, you do this work for 15 years and it's still something comes up tomorrow that I've never heard of before. But some of the common litigation issues that we deal with are about the provision of services to children and families, the continued sufficiency of those jurisdictional allegations, the intervention in court proceedings, and then overall permanency plans for children. If the return of a child to a family is not safe or legally possible, then our attorneys work with DHS and provide litigation services to help achieve legal, safe, and permanent placements for these children, which could include adoption subsequent to a termination of parental rights or relinquishment of parental rights, guardianship, as you heard about, or any other appropriate alternative under the statute. Our attorneys also specialize in certain areas. That we have foster care certification cases. We created a specialized unit to review those cases and assist DHS in staffing and moving forward with handling administrative hearings. We have specialty attorneys that deal with the Indian Child Welfare Act cases, international and immigration issues, interstate compact of the placement of children across state lines, and legislative review to assist the agency, DHS, and also rule review, administrative rule review. So while the law is consistent statewide, there really is kind of a difference on how these cases are heard by the courts in different counties. And as I alluded to earlier, and really the differences include the amount of oversight or review from a particular court. You know, some judges continually would like to see the case back every couple of months. Some counties, it's just maybe the permanency hearing is the first time the court will hear the case after the child comes into care, after the jurisdictional trial or admissions. There's courts that have the ability to group hearings in docket days, which we really involves increased efficiencies for the attorneys and for court scheduling and docket times. And also the access to services and the availability of resources for children and families does kind of change whether or not you're in a less populated portion of our state. And then finally, DOJ does have the benefit really of being able to coordinate our legal services among our other divisions at DOJ. So while we provide, as I've outlined, that legal advice and representation to DHS, we also have other divisions that work either with the Child Welfare Program at DHS or the larger DHS as an agency, which includes our appellate divisions, trial, general counsel, crime victim services, and criminal justice divisions. So we're able to somewhat cross with each other when issues overlap. overlap and provide information and background when necessary, which helps provide that continuity of legal services. So finally, our goal is really to present a comprehensive approach of legal advice and make that a quality, effective representation for the state for the purposes of achieving permanency, safety, and stability. And that really is to assist some of Oregon's most vulnerable children. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. I served as a CASA many years ago, and I did it because what was brought to my attention was that children don't actually are not assigned an attorney when something happens to them. That was what was explained to me at the time, versus an adult. If I were attacked or harmed in some way and I couldn't afford an attorney, one would be perhaps, under certain circumstances, appointed to me. Judge Waller, can you please, I'm only wanting to clarify for the committee and for others to really understand how little we do, at least in my estimation, the children are not getting the legal representation that an adult is given. Is that, can you talk a little bit about that,
Absolutely.
Please?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Taylor. I think that there has been a tremendous improvement around that we are now appointing children, and the goal is to appoint children counsel from the first hearing, the initial shelter hearing, which occurs within 24 hours of removal. In my jurisdiction, we have a group of lawyers ready to be appointed at those hearings that we hold every afternoon, and that's the goal across the state, is to have lawyers available for children. Okay. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't also have CASAs. They represent they represent the best interests of a child. A lawyer for a child who is able to direct the lawyer who's of an age where they can, and there's discussion about what that age is, and it's probably dependent upon the child, but for most children around the age of 10, they can direct their lawyers to what they want to have happen. The lawyer has a responsibility, as any lawyer, to advise their client as to the likely outcome. So a lawyer would work with the child for them to understand the choices that they have and the possibilities of something actually coming through. But I think that it's important for children to understand that they have representation that is representing their interests and they're directing what should happen.
Follow-up? Thank you. I'm so glad to hear, because about 18 years ago, I would not say at all that children were getting legal representation, and that was of great concern to me. So you feel that has been largely addressed, that children, if there's something comes up, that they are appointed an attorney pretty much across the state?
Yeah. Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Taylor, yeah, I would agree. I think when I first started about 14 years ago, yes, that was the case in some of the counties that children were not appointed attorneys until the termination of parental rights phase. That has definitely changed, and I can't think of a county now where they are not afforded some level of representation.
Happy to hear it. Thank you.
One more question, and then we want to move on to the...
It's a real quick comment. I applaud everyone in the room that has this advocacy for our kids, but I have to give a shout-out to Judge Waller,
yes,
who I can't remember when we started working together, but this is probably the most stellar and strong advocate for our kids throughout Multnomah County, if not the entire state. You have done tremendous things over all these years. And what's been cool, it's really been a single focus on our kids. I mean, I know you've done many, many other things, but from the days of seeing you sit at the bench at the Donald E. Long home to being here is just way cool. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to echo that, because the three of us served together in the County Commission of Children,
yes,
Families, and Communities. So I have also known you for more than a decade, and also through the Portland Children's Levy. You've been a huge supporter of child welfare programs.
And, well, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Palusa, it is wonderful to see, and I know that the others on the committee are as equally passionate about making sure that the most vulnerable children in Oregon have a fair shake and have what they deserve. So thank you all for serving on the committee and for your interest and passion on making sure the outcomes are what we need when we have responsibility for children.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for that. And now we'd like to call up James Barda, Lisa McMahon, Joshua Ashbach, and Zachary Miller. It's our last panel for the informational hearing. And then we will move on to the four bills.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First, and one of the perks I have found in this position is to be working with the Oregon Foster Youth Connection and getting to know the youths that are involved. They are tremendous talents, and I'm hoping that some of them think about interning and working here at the Capitol at some point. But in the interest of time, I'd like to turn the mic over to them.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Lisa McMahon, and I'm the program director of Oregon Foster Youth Connection. And I just wanted to take a second today to focus us on to the idea of transitions. So youth in foster care experience transitions, right? We know that. So they transition into foster care. DHS, I think, is doing a great job with this differentiated response rollout, very strategic and thought through, and I'm really appreciative of that, hopefully keeping youth in their homes so they experience less transition. But I did want to highlight that there are over 900 youth in 2013, looking at 2013 data as well, over 900 youth who are experiencing six or more transitions while they're in foster care. So there are a lot of youth who are experiencing a lot of transition when they're in foster care, which is not the goal of the system. It's not our goal, but it's a reality that happens for some youth. And so youth in the Oregon Foster Youth Connection highlight the fact that while they're in that system and experiencing those transitions, they would like to experience some normalcy. So thinking about anything that we can do to support that idea of their well-being and thriving as young adults, and what makes them happy. So focusing on some of those things as well as their safety is important. And then I just wanted to also highlight transitioning out of foster care. So there are many youth who age out of the system. So they turn 18 or they turn 21 or somewhere in that range, and they don't have a permanent home. They don't have a permanent connection. So the number for that is over 300 youth are experiencing that transition. And so any support that we can give them to feel any sort of connection, maybe it's not somebody that they're living with, but what sort of permanency can we give them? What sort of community can they feel? When you become an adult, those kind of links are important. So then I just want to pass over to Joshua, who's going to talk about his experiences with transitions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kennedy Geyer and members of the committee. My name is, for the record, Joshua Ashbaugh, and I'm a member of Oregon Foster Youth Connection. I'm going to be giving you guys just, basically from place to place and the different levels of placement I've been in, and then how it impacted me and how it helped me to be where I'm at today. So growing up, I didn't really have a lot of stability in my immediate family due to poor living conditions and a constant struggle to find food. And a job, a single mother with three kids had no choice but to let us go to the Department of Human Services. At first, it was scary. I was in sixth grade, had no idea what was really going on. And I had my brother and my sister with me, and fortunately, we stuck together with one family. And that family was nice. The household was in fair condition, and all in all, it was a good placement. My mother got her act together a year later and took all three of us back, and we moved home. Shortly after, my mother fell back into the lifestyle that she was accustomed to, and that was criminal activity and a vigorous battle with addiction. And my mother decided to run from the state. Because of this, I went into care again at the end of eighth grade, and before I was placed in a more permanent foster home, my brother and sister and I were placed in an emergency foster home for about 4 or 5 days. And that experience was a little rough as well, but we stuck through it together. And back in eighth grade, I was actually close friends with a guy named Oliver. And his family basically saved my sister and I's lives. They took us in for a long period of time. My mother wasn't able to take us back, and so ended up staying with them for about 5 years. And my brother was placed in the same county, actually quite close, right down the street. So it was really good that we got to stay connected. And he was there for the same amount of time and just recently actually moved out of care and became independent, which is great. And so Oliver, my best friend, and his family were very wealthy compared to my current standard of living or living situation. In other words, they were more middle class, I was lower class. Going from no cars and homeless to six cars and two houses, it was a big change. It was dramatic. So that was a tough transition. It was kind of overwhelming at first, but I'm good at adapting. And so with that, I'm actually a little nervous right now.
We're doing great.
Kind of intimidating. So with that, they actually were well educated and had a structured plan for my sister and I, which was actually kind of heartwarming. And so with that, they were very understanding of our needs and wants, and that was pretty cool. With freshman year came around, I dedicated myself to being successful, obeying the system, regulations of DHS, ILP, and school. And I realized that there was opportunity with the services that were available, and power to change my future. And my foster parents were very supportive and truly loved me as if I were their own. I stayed with them throughout high school and just recently moved into another home because of unhealthy relationships. Currently, I'm well-treated and respected where I'm at now, and things are going smoothly, and there is a transition plan being made right now, and that is in process to become more successful. Thank you.
You did a great job.
Good afternoon, Chair Kinney-Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Zachary Miller, and I am a member of the Oregon Foster Youth Connection. Now, I've met some of the representatives here on the committee, so some of you do know what the Oregon Foster Youth Connection is. But for those of you that don't, the Oregon Foster Youth Connection is a youth-led organization started in about 2008 with the goal of making the Oregon foster care system better through activism, leadership, and advocacy. And what we mean by youth-led is all the ideas we've came up with for bills that we've presented, even the bills we're presenting here today, have all come up. These have been youth ideas. So the process that usually happens is we usually have throughout this session, so for about 2 years, we have youth come up with ideas of what sort of issues we want to tackle in the legislative session. And then during the summer, we have a policy summit, where we have all the youth come together for a weekend, have some fun, but also help solidify some of these issues that we want to tackle. And at the end of this, we present these to higher-ups on DHS, judges, caseworkers, whoever wants to come and listen to our presentations. And then the following spring, February, as in this last February is when we came here, as we do an advocacy weekend. And so we have the youth come, we bring our ideas. Normally before, it's just been one idea per advocacy session, but this time around, we decided to kick it up a notch and bring two ideas. So we have a weekend of practicing presentations, getting them solidified, and then we come in sort of like teams to the Capitol and present these ideas to various representatives and senators, and then we sort of pick out a legislative action team, which, me, Josh here, and then two other members here today, will come to these sort of hearings and testify on these. Successes we've had so far, the first one we had was a bill that helped foster youth get driver's ed and be able to get their permits and licenses. And then the next one after that, I believe, was extending health care for foster youth, 21, and then with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, I understand that's been extended to 26. And then after that, we had the tuition waivers for foster youth at Oregon Public two-year and four-year colleges. So the way that works is, the FAFSA doesn't cover for the tuition. This bill steps in and covers the rest, so that foster youth don't really have to worry about tuition. And then, of course, the most recent one, most recent success, is the Foster Youth Bill of Rights and the implementation of the Foster Care Ombudsman. And so we really also want to thank you all for your support and helping us so far. And the two bills, you know, we're going to be talking to you about today, actually one of them has a bit of an overlap with the HB 4980, which is the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act, which was actually kind of a happy coincidence. But
Zachary?
Yes.
You know, if you're ready to start talking about the bills, then I might close the informational hearing and actually open the public hearing. Are you ready to move on to the bill?
Yes, as a matter of fact,
okay,
I am.
Okay, I'm
going to
close the informational hearing, and I'm going to open the public hearing on 2890, and we'll ask our administrator for a summary of the bill first.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2890. Directs Department of Human Services in coordination with agencies and foster parents to provide for participation in extracurricular activities for children in care of department. And
just that one.
Oh, did you just open
We'll just do that one first. And so Lisa and Zachary are staying, and if Alexis Baska and Don Darlin can come up and join. And great. So you did you want to continue where you were? Who would like to start off the public hearing on 2890?
I would.
You would. Great.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alexis Baska, and I am a member of the Oregon Foster Youth Connections. So at the OFYC policy conference last summer, youth from across the state felt that they weren't getting the access that other teens or youth were for extracurricular activities. It was such a big problem that we decided to address it. So our bill highlights that all children and youth have the opportunity, if they are interested, to participate in at least one extracurricular activity or of development, if it's appropriate for their development and maturity. It could be things such as a play date, basketball, youth group, things like that. Something that is important to the youth. There will also be more accountability on DHS. They'll have to work with the foster parent, the youth, and the community to try to work through these challenges. Not all youth are strong advocates for themselves. They need somebody to help them sometimes, whether it be an adult or other youth like we are. We hope that the youth and foster parents will feel supported by DHS and the community to work together through the needs of the foster youth. Since introducing this bill, we have heard from a variety of resources for youth and families, from school fee waivers to Friends of Baseball and Foster Parent Association, to name a few. We have made an amendment. We have added a few definitions as they are used in the federal legislation. We clarified some language requested by DHS. Do you have any questions, comments before I move on to my story?
Do you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Kinnegay. And this can, whether you answer now or maybe if someone can answer this. I'm reading the amendments, and it seems as though the amendments go pretty specific into definitions, but it seems like the original bill of, you know, that this would ensure, I'm not quite sure how the amendments accomplished the original bill other than spelling out some definitions. When I read the amendments, given that it was a complete gut and stuff, like all the wording from the original was removed, because I'm reading deletes line 4 through 12 is the first part of the amendment. We may want to look at that again then, in case there's another amendment.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark. That was not my understanding of the amendment. My understanding of the amendment that we were adding definitions, and there were lines that were removed, but also lines added for clarification. But there were, so I guess we should clarify the amendment.
Yes, because the amendment says lines 4 through 12 would be deleted, and then insert. the rest. So we'll need to visit that again later for before work session.
Chair Kenny Geyer.
And if you can restate your name for the record.
Oh, sorry. Lisa McMahon. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark. I think James Sparta will be up at the end, and I think he will be able to clarify the answer to that question.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Alexis Baska. I am 18 years old and a senior at Vernonia High School. I entered into the foster care system 3 years ago at the age of 15. I was a freshman in high school. Before entering into care, I had no idea what foster care is. I'd never heard of it. I couldn't even imagine not living with my parent, my mother, father, or a grandparent. As a freshman, my whole world got turned upside down. My mom was struggling with addiction. My dad died very suddenly, and I entered into the foster care system. However, I am one of the lucky ones. That's what I consider myself. I was placed with an aunt and uncle in the same town. I went to the same school, surrounded by the same people. I was very blessed. My aunt and uncle, even though they were near strangers to me, I knew that I was in a loving and safe environment. Something I quickly realized is that you'll always have a certain place in your heart for your parents, no matter how much they've put you through. After my father died, I felt the need to protect my mom. I had this anxiety that if I wasn't with her, then she would die too. I got really stressed and depressed. I knew that I needed something to help me push through my challenges or I would shut down. I put all I had into extracurricular activities. They became my outlet and it helped immensely. I learned more about myself in a few months than I had in my 15 years of life. My foster mom and caseworker both encouraged my extracurricular activity participation. They told me often how impressed they were by me. I was at the same school, so it was very easy to stay involved in my extracurricular activities. Something that I loved about extracurricular activities is that it couldn't be taken away from you. It's something that you didn't have to worry about being gone tomorrow. It was a safe thing, stable. Because of my extracurricular activities, I came to realize I love helping others. I love being a leader and standing up for what I believe in. Also, I figured out kind of what I plan to do after I graduate in May. I think that if it weren't for them, then I probably would not have a plan on what I'm going to do after graduating high school, because I found more about who I am and what I want out of life in 4 years of extracurricular activities than I ever imagined. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So what's the plan after high school?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative. After high school, I have applied for Western or Eastern Oregon. Though Western is my first choice, so I'm not too far from here. I want to major in psychology with a minor in communications, and then either go on to get my master's in psychology or transfer to Portland State go into human resourcing, get a human resource degree because the two go hand in hand, and then hopefully become a human resource manager.
I have a feeling it's all going to happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment. Also, I know you've been through a lot of turmoil because I was the project manager for rebuilding the Vernonia schools, which got completed about 3 years ago, so there's a lot going on at that time. But thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I myself also have a story to share involving this. I was put into foster care when I was, for the record, my name is Zachary Miller. When I was 13, I was placed into foster care from an adopted home. And shortly afterwards, just as with Alexis, my father passed away. And so, being in middle school and going through the craziness that's getting put into foster care and then your father dying, you don't really know what to do with yourself. And my first foster parents at the time didn't really encourage extracurricular activities. I had a brother who was like, hey, do community theater. So I did community theater and I found it helped, but it didn't help it everything. And so after freshman year of high school, I decided to move to Jackson County in Ashland because I really had and have a passion for music and theater. And so once I moved in there with my foster parents, it's a completely different experience. They pushed me to do extracurriculars. You know, I moved in, they're like, you know, you should really try football. They'd get you in really good shape. I'm like, all right. And then suddenly once, you know, they had that push for me to do football and more extracurriculars, I suddenly found myself getting involved with everything. So the choir, the theater, leadership. I even tried the cheer team one season. That was interesting. And the swim team. But, you know, with the encouragement to do the extracurricular activities and, you know, even being a part of the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, could be, you know, an extracurricular, you know. Without the encouragement and the participation in these extracurriculars, I wouldn't have, you know, it helped me greatly develop the skills that I would need later in life as an adult, like, people skills, confidence to talk in front of people, learn how to just generally be sociable, things like that, work on a team. And just like Alexis, it helped me kind of figure out what I wanted to do. And it's been a while, but, you know, I'm actually planning on going to Lane Community College this spring. Not sure what I want to do yet. I'm either thinking either computer software or something with the radio. So we'll see what happens.
Will keep us in tune. Yeah, keep us updated. That's great. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Hi, this is Lisa McMahon again, and I just wanted to state that it's been a great pleasure to work with DHS and the Foster Parent Association and other groups who are really looking to support the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, and it's been really great to have their support in this legislation.
Hopefully this is close enough for
it's
the record.
It's close enough. It's good.
My name is Don Darland. I'm from SIO, Linn County foster parent. Kenny Geyer and the committee members. If I could physically, I would give these kids a standing ovation, but I can't. But I've been a foster parent, my wife and I, for about 24 years now. And I actually started the Foster Parent Association in 97 and been on the board ever since, trying to retire. And what I want to say about extracurricular activities is when I listen to these young people speak, and some of their experience are the exceptions, because there's so many kids that, and I don't know how many, but there's some that just do not get to participate for whatever reason. Some of them have therapy. Some have visits every week. They might have two or three visits. They might have therapy. They might, in a foster home, might have five or six kids in it. And not only that, their own biological children. There's so many barriers that they're, you know, but we've got to have the discussion. And one of my mantras over these years is rules without relationship lead to rebellion. I plagiarized that from somebody, so I can't claim it as my own. But these bills, both of them, but this bill in particular, starts again that conversation between caseworkers, foster parents, CASAs, attorneys. The team of folks around these kids are so important. And that's where the team needs to gather around and say, okay, how can we make this happen as a team? It's not just the foster parent. It's not just DHS. It's not just, you know, we got to come as a community and a team. And I'm glad to see that this is coming up again. Now, I have reached out in our social media, and I didn't bring all that, but many foster parents gave me examples. I asked them, give me examples of what you're doing to get extracurricular activities. And many of them had examples and creative examples, but they also talked about barriers. Sports fees, $250 some to participate, cleats, uniforms, those type of things. So I think the greater discussion hopefully will at some point be, what are the barriers? How can we get that? And I don't think you can legislate just good case practice. this is good case practice. We've known it for years. Mm-hmm. Kids need extracurricular activities. Mm-hmm. So hopefully this continues and we have that conversation, because it is in the federal bill too. So thank you very much. If there's any questions.
Thank you. Any questions on this bill before we move to the next one? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Just briefly, if you could speak to the scope of it. I personally raise horses. I find it very, very therapeutic for my stressful new job here. But I know that there's risk and concern with that type of thing. What level are you looking for? Would equine sports be an option?
I can speak to that.
Yep. Just introduce your name again for the record so people listening in know who's talking.
Again, for the record, my name's Don Darland, D-A-R-L-A-N-D, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden. Actually, equine sports are being done with foster children, and they're very effective. In fact, there are some, I can't name what they are, but they're therapeutic. Mm-hmm. In nature, their whole ranch is therapeutic. And we found several cases that in the past where children, their behaviors have been decreased because of the equine and the horse therapy. And so that's one of many things that are already being done.
Good.
One more question, Representative
Stark. Thank you, Zachary and Alexis, both of you, for sharing as well. For all of you, but I especially appreciate hearing your story. Alexis, when you were in my office and we talked about this, I asked you a question. I'm curious if you put some thought into it. And I asked you, how would this be enforced? Where along the timeline, who would be checking in to make sure that that someone actually is having the opportunity and making those decisions? So how is it regulated and enforced? What happens if it's not? And we discussed that some, and you said, I'll think about that.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, for the record, my name is Alexis Baska. I personally am very busy, obviously, like the rest of you, with extracurricular activities and such, planning to go to college. But I have thought off and on about it. I haven't done any real research on it, or haven't asked what the policy would be, but I personally think that we have an ombudsman now. The foster youth itself could tell the ombudsman that it's not happening, they're not being able to participate in extracurricular activities. I think that as we get these rights, that foster youth feel more confident in saying what they want in their life. So I think that with the help of the ombudsman and the passing of the bills, they'll feel like it's on paper that they can do these things, that there's proof that they legally have to. I think that they could speak with their caseworker. If they have a CASA, they can speak with their CASA about what's going on. If maybe even their lawyer, if they want to take it that far, their ombudsman. I think that there's a lot of different possibilities on how they can address it and make sure we also have, at least being in care, we meet with panels every 6 months, I believe, where they kind of review our cases. We can talk about it there. I know I personally have a court hearing once a year. We can talk about it there if it needs, like I said, they can talk to the ombudsman or lawyer if it needs to be taken care of sooner. I don't know what legal precautions would happen, but I imagine that DHS or their lawyer, somebody will talk to the foster parent and tell them that they need to help with ensuring that the youth gets to participate in extracurricular activities. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark. Once again, for the record, my name is Zachary Miller. If I may add to what Alexis said, That same sort of question was posed to my group as well on Advocacy Day, and one of the things that we thought about was maybe providing an incentive for foster parents instead of disincentivizing them, you know, like, you know, if you don't do it, this will happen, instead of, you know, if you do this, you know, this will happen, sort of negotiate, provide incentives for foster parents to do this sort of thing. So I think that may be one of the better answers, I guess, better answers to that question, better resolutions for that.
So I was just going to say, having been involved at the early stages of drafting the bill, we did not put any legal enforcement in this. There is actually already funds at DHS to help families with transportation or fees or things like that in extracurricular activities. The purpose of this is in part to really elevate the importance, because it came from the kids. Out of all the things that can help make life better and more enriching for foster youth, this is one of the things that rose to the top in that biennial conference that they had. And so I think it's really a big statement that this is an expectation of foster families up front. So I think it's, you know, it's true, there's an ombudsman, and if it's not happening, even when there are funds to draw upon, and there's a very clear expectation by the state, an affirmation of the priority that the youth themselves put on it, then we would take next steps. One more question, and then we want to make sure we have time for at least one more bill.
So thank you for bringing the bill. I appreciate it. How do you envision this working with, like, high-needs kids that are in foster care for whom playing football isn't an option, or swimming or cheerleading? I mean, you've got kids in foster care who are totally ambulatory, and so I get that there's not an enforcement piece, but where is also that recognition of which kids might not an extracurricular activity be applicable to, and is that going to be decided through an administrative rule, or I'm just kind of curious how that falls down.
Yes, Representative Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Parrish, once again, for the record, my name is Zachary Miller. I think that sort of thing would help decided by, you know, like, the caseworker, foster parent, and the foster youth themselves. I mean, extracurriculars isn't necessarily applying to just sports. You know, so, like, if they're, you know, if they were the, you know, if they really liked chess and there's a chess team at the school, you know, there's that. Or, you know, freshman year I was on the debate team, you know, something like that. Or something simple, just like a youth group or something. Just as long as the youth have the opportunity to do something, you know, as an extracurricular. Okay. I hope that answers your question somewhat.
One more response?
Hi, yeah. Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Parrish. This is Lisa McMahon again. And so the bill clearly states age appropriate and developmentally appropriate. And so we're hoping that that is all encompassing. So at the developmental appropriateness, what is an activity this youth might want? So maybe the youth going to a choir practice and just being around the music because they love music so much is a way for them to experience their community. They can, I'm just thinking about a youth who maybe is not communicative and can't physically do anything, but if you put them in a church, if they love music, they can feel the organ, they can feel the people singing. So maybe that's something that they experience as something that they enjoy. So it's really, I think, about finding things that, what is something that that youth enjoys, and then finding ways to do that. So it can be very simple in that context. I'm thinking about many ways. I have a background in special education, and so that is a really good, important question for me, and I loved that this bill is really about age appropriateness and developmentally appropriateness, because I don't want it to be just because someone has a significant disability, they can't do something that's extracurricular. It's just a broad definition for what's appropriate for that youth.
Thank you. I am going to close the public hearing. On
can I add one last little thing?
Quickly.
It's not even a question.
I just don't want to run out of time for the other.
I do want to clarify. I did discover the answer to my question earlier about the amendment, okay, where I thought there was a mistake. They took the original language from the original bill and put it at the bottom of the amendment.
And so I was reading where we deleted all of the original bill. So it is in there.
Okay.
James is back there giving a thumbs up. So okay. It's all in there.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2889. Open the public hearing on 2890. And a couple of you are also on that panel, Lisa McMahon and Don Darland. You can stay. And I'd like to call up Kane Stellings, Joshua Ashbaugh, and I guess Pam Levitt will go after that. I want to just check right now. Janet Arends, are you able to come back? Because it looks like we're going to need to hold over 2233 and 2414 till Wednesday. That would be great, because we want to make sure that these guys have enough time. Who wants to kick it off?
Oh, well, I guess that's my job.
All right. Great.
Okay. Hello and good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Kane Stellings. I am 18 years old. I was 17 last year. I'm 18. I'm a freshman at Lane Community College, and I am currently involved in the Oregon Foster Youth Connection. We're here today because we're advocating for two bills, and these two bills are HB 2889 and HB 2890. 2890 has already been represented as extracurricular activities. And then 2889. Oh, that's okay. 2889 is addressing youth being strongly encouraged to open a savings account. It says here. All right. As Zach mentioned, at OFYC, we have policy conferences to figure out what we're going to be bringing to the Capitol on behalf of foster youth in the state of Oregon. So at the OFYC policy conference this last summer, youth across the state identified that when youth aged out of foster care, one of the problems was that they felt that they were not financially ready. And so here at OFYC, we decided to do something about this, and we decided that the best thing we could do was to bring it to the Capitol and see what we could do here, you know. So with our piece of legislation, we are focusing on many different things, but I'm just going to highlight for the sake of time just a few of them. Youth will start practicing financial responsibility much earlier by opening these savings accounts starting at the age of 12. The age of 12 we felt was a good age because this is usually when puberty starts to kick in and youth actually kind of want to start making their own money. You know, grandma starts letting them mow their yard, clean the stairs. I mean, I've done my fair share for $20. Second one is youth will be able to have the opportunity to learn through their mistakes much earlier. I personally believe that if I was able to open a bank account and learn money management earlier in life, that I wouldn't have fallen into the stereotypical realm of college students living off a steady diet of rice, potatoes, and top ramen. And then finally, youth will be solely responsible for the management of their savings. I did have a bank account throughout high school. That's one thing. And one of those things was is I had to save up for my own money to take with me on sporting activities. I'm a triathlete, three different sports. And so that just kind of got costly, you know, and wise food-wise because being a heavyweight wrestler and one of the biggest guys on the football team, you know, I got to kind of keep my weight up, you know, so I can't stop eating. Sorry, Mom. We are currently working with some of the credit unions to problem solve around youth receiving statements and maintaining access to their money when they move. One of the great things about a credit union here in Oregon is that, let's say, a youth moves from LeGrand in eastern Oregon all the way to Portland, they'd still have access to their money through a credit union with no additional fee. So we thought that would be an awesome, like, up for savings accounts and youth being on the move. This was also a great thing to see because me, living the triathlete lifestyle throughout high school, I didn't always have access to my bank because we actually lived 12 miles from the nearest bank.
So my foster mom was actually co-signed onto it. Now, this was great because she was able to help me get money for when I needed sports and whatnot. One downside of it is that she had access to everything. She could withdraw money. She could see my bank account. She could make edits to my accounts without me knowing until I got an email notification saying that something had changed, you know? I'm not saying that that happened because I didn't necessarily have that situation, but the fact that it could really scares me. And so at credit unions, we found out that if youth are underage, they are allowed to open up an account without a co-signer. So we thought that would be an awesome up for this bill. You will see some amendments we have made to the bill, and I will just highlight though, well, amendment one, I'm supposed to know. We are not requiring any financial institutions to open a bank account. I think that's, we don't want them to have to open a bank account for anybody. Like, that's not their job. It's the youth. We are adding that the financial institution is not obligated to determine if there is any coercion or if the youth chooses to add an adult to their account. So right now, we're trying to go for no co-signers on the account, but after the youth's made the account, they have the opportunity to choose who they want to put on their account as a co-signer. Like, let's say they trusted grandma. Like, grandma's a good source. Like, I trust her with my money. Let's put grandma on here just in case. We are removing the requirement of overdraft protection. This would have required the financial institution to open a line of credit for the youth. I've also saw here that we found that the state independent living program already runs credit reports for the youth just to see if there's any like activity going on there, just like keep tabs that way. So I didn't know that until I like started researching this, so I thought that was kind of cool. I would just like to thank you guys for your time, and I will now pass this, well, if you guys don't have any questions for me. No question?
Chair Kenny Geyer, so correct me if I'm wrong here, under a credit union you would be able to currently do this, right? Or is that incorrect?
Your own account? Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, yes, we would be able to. You're asking to open a bank account, correct? Like just being open without a co-signer.
Yes.
Yes, that is something.
So your request is to extend that to banking?
No. Well, I don't know.
I honestly
wouldn't know the answer to that question. I don't think we were, but Lisa would know the answer to that question.
And one follow-up real quick question. Is there a barrier for foster children to have ownership of pets greater than the average kid? Is it harder for a foster child to have a pet dog or a cat or something on average? I think pets are great.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, I have no idea about pets, so that's a really good question, but hopefully someone else has an answer to that. But in reference to what's legal, so it's currently legal for a minor to open a savings account in the state of Oregon at a bank or a credit union. What's not currently okay is right now if a youth opens a savings account at a bank and they somehow manage to overdraw it, a bank cannot hold the youth liable for that negative balance because they're a minor and the bank can't really legally do anything. So one of the lines in our legislation removes that, so the youth is now will be held accountable for that, and so it kind of makes it safer for credit unions and banks to be able to open a savings account for youth, because youth will be responsible. And so both at savings accounts and credit unions it's legal. It's just the point of practice of who's willing to take that step and do it. Thanks.
I have a follow-up question. Is that because normally there is an adult on it, and now because we're removing the necessity for an adult to be on it, and it falls back just to the youth, that's why you're having to add that holding kids responsible?
Chair Kenny Geyer.
I see. I know that we have someone from the credit union coming up after this, so we can also ask her to clarify.
Yeah. So the my understanding is that it's legal with or without an adult as it is. It's less likely that they're doing it because they can't, with an adult, they can hold the cosigner responsible for the negative balance, but they can't hold a minor responsible for that. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay. Yep. Is there concern at all with now saying that, you know, the onus falls on the minor about what happens to if there is sort of that overdrawn account and then an account gets closed and it goes to a collection, that showing up on a kid's credit bureau in the future and what that does to them walking through? And I'll just, you know, share. I mean, I wasn't in foster care, but probably should have been. And, you know, had a parent who destroyed our credit before we were even 18 in putting things in our name. And, you know, so I got the first time I ever pulled the credit bureau, it had all kinds of things on there that I didn't even know, you know, what they were. And I spent the first, you know, 5 years of my adult life trying to clean up something I didn't do. And so I worry about the relationship of a credit bureau situation of a youth that gets into trouble with an account. There is no adult on the account or somebody who's sort of paying attention to that, and it gets into a collection situation and destroys a child's credit before they ever had an opportunity to establish credit in a meaningful way, because just simply having an account doesn't show up on your bureau, but the minute that you show up into a collection situation, that will wind up in there. And I have real concerns about just, you know, putting a kid into a situation where they're not tracking that, and then you go to, you know, apply for your first credit card or you go an apartment or anything else that's going to require a credit bureau pull for a kid who's aging out of the system, and we're aging them out potentially in a situation where they've got negative reports on their credit bureau.
So quick response, because we do have someone from the credit card union and we're about to close the hearing, and I want to make sure you have an opportunity to comment as well.
Can we leave that question?
Yes, I know. Several people we want to hear from still, so.
Yes. Chair Kennedy Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joshua Ashbaugh. I'm just going to share a short story about how opening up a savings account was beneficial to me. Growing up, I did have fortunate. I was in a great, supportive foster family that was very well educated. CEOs of companies and knew exactly what they were talking about with financials and knowledge with business. And they helped me set up a savings account at age 14. And with this, they also helped me establish a little local lawn maintenance company, and that kept our community neat, as well as I got a small personal earning of income. And with that, I obtained more understanding of business and the financial importance growing up, and I used that in high school. And I actually pursued a lot of courses that had to do with financials and business. I'm going to list some of those off. Business and management, intro to business and management 1 and 2, accounting 1 and 2, financing 1 and 2, and basically all of the business courses, just because they told me how important money was and what it could do to be successful, and basically budgeting, time management, it all kind of related to growing responsibly. And so without that kind of supportive attitude at a young age, I don't know if I would have been here today with the financial setup that I have. I am saving correctly. I am growing responsibly. I have time management. I keep up on my emails at 18. That's kind of weird to say, but it's kind of cool. It's cool that I can grow up and be able to look back and see the growth with that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Joshua. Don.
I'll just make this real quick, Chair Geyer and the committee members. For the record, my name is Don Darlin from Oregon Foster Parent Association. And in concept and in spirit, we just support this bill. And there's many foster parents already doing that now, is creating savings and checking accounts. And again, it's getting the discussion happening with the team to train the children how to manage money, however that's going to happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, we've got two people. Hopefully, committee, you can stay for a few more minutes. Pam Levitt and James Barta. You can answer some of the technical questions.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. I will be brief. You have my testimony and Olis. First, I want to say, you know, I'm in this building every day, and, you know, I often get to sit in on hearings, bills I'm not tracking. I was really inspired by the bill before me. I have two kids in full-time sports. I write those checks every quarter, and I just really support the efforts of those kids to have these extracurricular activities. So I wanted to add that. You have my testimony. Credit unions are not-for-profit financial institutions. Financial literacy, teaching people how to manage their money, supporting youth in financial education is part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. I've been working on financial education issues in this building for several years. And so when the Children First and Oregon Foster Youth Connection came to us with this bill, we were really thrilled to be able to work with them because we want to certainly support the foster youth being able to not only have access to accounts on their own, but also learning financial education and savings and all of those wonderful things that come about with financial literacy. So we're here today in support of House Bill 2889 and the -1 Amendment. Our attorney worked with James to craft language that would work from a contractual account language that works within our credit unions, and it does work with both banks and credit unions. The language of the amendment is financial institutions. But we have, in practice, if you are a foster youth or a youth of any kind over the age of 12, you would have a co-signer come in and open an account with you. And the foster youth, for many reasons, want to be able to open these accounts without having a co-signer. So we fixed the contractual language to be able to do that. This issue is not just a legislative issue. It's really going to be an issue of education to credit unions. Why is it important to really welcome these foster youth on their own into our credit unions and give them financial literacy? But it's going to be education to different organizations on helping them understand financial literacy and guide them to financial institutions. When James and I were working on this amendment, I was telling him that all the credit unions are connected via ATMs and shared branching. So I'm a member of a credit union downtown Portland, but I do my branching at another credit union. That's called our Share Branch Network. That was appealing to them because they have foster youth in different communities moving around. We're also all connected at 7-Eleven stores. You can go do any free transactions with your credit union at any 7-Eleven store. So we try to have a collaborative network because we are smaller financial institutions. So I just wanted to say thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to be brief. You have my full testimony, and I will.
James. Representative Buehler, question for Pam.
Yes, sir. Pam, quick question.
Yes, sir.
Is there a way to coordinate this program in any way with individual development accounts? So there's
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Buehler. I believe so. On the IDA, Individual Development Account legislation, I've been talking to some of the advocates on how to really work with them. You know, credit unions are still membership-based, so you need to be part of either a business or a community to join. And so some of those issues have been preventative for IDA programs, but I think it's a wonderful connection, and I believe there's a lot more discussion to be had there. So,
Paul, is there something we can do with this legislation to facilitate that?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Buehler, I don't know the answer to that. My belief would be it would need to be within the IDA legislative statutes, but might have a better idea.
One more question from Representative Parrish.
So, Pam, I'd like to follow up on the credit bureau issue and account that gets overdrafted, and the minor is now the sole person in charge of that account. What's that going to do on their credit report if they go into default and you send it to collections? And then the other piece I'm just curious about is around, you know, we saw the number that says how many kids are reunified with families. Minor has the account. I'm now his parent, and I'm back sort of in control of my child. Do I have control over this asset?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish. We did discuss overdraft possibilities. And, you know, this was part of the concept. The youth will now be responsible. The goal of this bill is to not have a co-signer, to give them that independence. And part of that independence, I believe, the goal is to, you know, they need to learn if they overdraft that there are consequences. Now, will the committee be going after a 18-year-old for a $15 overdraft in small claims court? Probably not. There'll be a teachable moment at that opportunity. But we wanted to be able to at least enter down this path of giving them that financial independence.
I follow up. Mm-hmm. So while you might not take the child to small claims court, does the $15 show up in a collection agency that then reports to a child's credit bureau? And that's what I'm really sort of trying to wrap my head around is, you know, suddenly you've got an outstanding, you know, ABC collection agency or whatever is sitting there on a child who has overdraft something at 17 and you're out, you know, collecting it, and then that child goes as an 18-year-old to seek credit or seek an apartment, or they age out of the system, mm-hmm. and they're there with something on their bureau that doesn't let them, you know, have that credit worthiness that they need to move forward in life. And I'm totally supportive of the idea of letting these kids have accounts, and particularly if the parent can't touch the account if they do go back into foster, mm-hmm. that's a big piece for me. But I am worried about my 15-year-old kid not understanding what it means that by not following through, and right now our kids do have savings accounts, and they overdraft to, you know, their debit account overdrafts to a savings account that overdrafts to the parents. So, I mean, there's like a chain there, and not having some kind of system where a 16-year-old child in foster care who may or may not have a foster parent who understands, you know, personal finance, what happens if that uncollectible $1,500 or whatever shows up on their bureau and ruins their credit? And I think is a real issue.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish, you know, we're now speaking as if the bill has passed, because right now there is a co-signer on all of the accounts we have with youth. So I would have to follow up with you and maybe talk through this with some of our folks and find out what real life circumstances might hold. I don't know the answer to that, if it would show up on there. I mean,
well, I think these are good questions because, uh-huh. you know, it's a savings account. The only way I can imagine an overdraft happening is if you say that you're depositing a certain amount and then you withdraw more than what you've said you say you're depositing 100, but then the 100's not really good. And so there might be something we'd want to look at something has to clear 24 hours first before it can be drawn upon. I mean, there may be other ways to get at this mm-hmm. with special regulations if you are going to go to one person. So I don't know. Those are good points. But James.
Kenny Geyer, my name is James Barta, Legislative Director with Children First. And to talk about that, yes, we definitely came in knowing it would have to be a savings account to help protect financial institutions from potential overdrafts. And the actual nature of the accounts is something that we're looking forward to working with the credit unions and whoever else to see exactly what the terms of the accounts. We're hoping that this will be a mutually beneficial relationship, that this is something that they can demonstrate their commitment to working with the community, and at the same time, you know, protecting. This is a good opportunity for the youth then to learn. You know, if you play a trick, I mean, we've heard in conversations with officials from other states that, you know, youth can figure out some pretty nifty tricks to try to get around the rules, but there are repercussions for it. And so by restricting it to a particular account, and in this case a savings account, we're hoping to lower that risk down the road.
Follow up. The other, and then I've got to go because I've got a 5:15. But the other question I had though then goes to is what's the bill say in terms of a child has an account, they created it with a foster parent, they get back into a situation where they've been sent back into their home. That may or may not be a good situation for them. Does that parent then have the ability, because I am their parent and guardian, to be able to tap that asset even if the parent's name's not on it? Like, could they, because I'm their parent, go back and say, well, no, we're going to either, one, they could go into the credit union and get it, or two, by exerting some kind of control or influence over the child to...
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish. This is an issue we have been discussing, and for the moment, I don't have an answer for you.
Okay.
I will get back to you on that.
Last question.
Last question. Line 5 of the bill says who is in the custody of the Department of Human Services, not who is in or has been in. Right? So it says they have to be currently in it. So to her point that if they get replaced in the home, currently they would lose that right.
Representative Kenny Geyer, or Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, this allows them to set up the account. It doesn't speak to what they do afterwards. And so my assumption is that they will still have access to this account that was set up under these rules.
Okay. That'd be good.
Good questions. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2889. I'm sorry that I misspoke the number before. And I'm going to hold over the House Bills 2233 and 2414. I am going to adjourn the meeting. Adjourn.